From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. The House approves a $700 billion financial rescue plan. We'll hear from some California lawmakers who agonized over their vote. Also, they can't cast ballots in this year's election, but some undocumented immigrants are knocking on doors and registering voters, and not everyone is happy about it.
A lot of people that have come into the country have done it the right way. They've gained citizenship, and it belittles those people when somebody else who is here illegally tries to influence the elections.
Also, bumpers, bells, and blinking lights. One of the nation's largest pinball expos comes to California.
I always just was fascinated by the fact that we as a society would build a machine that was purely for amusement. I just thought, wow, what a crazy contraption.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Those stories next on the California Report. Well, President Bush took less than an hour to sign the financial rescue bill passed by the House Friday. Given the stunning defeat of a similar bill Monday, the margin of victory was surprisingly wide, 263 to 171. California's delegation overwhelmingly supported the plan, with seven Democrats and one Republican switching their votes from no to yes. But not all the switch hitters were happy about it. Oakland Democrat Barbara Lee said she didn't even know if the bailout would work. But the East Bay Liberal says she felt she had no choice but to cave in to pressure for passing the plan.
I spoke with our California treasurer this week, and he assured me that people will suffer greater pain, including cuts to critical state-funded social services, county services, and schools, if we don't do something to stop this hemorrhaging. That's why I will vote for this bill today.
The only Republican from California who changed his vote was moderate David Dreyer from the San Gabriel Valley. But all the warnings of an economic calamity weren't enough to push Riverside County Republican Daryl Issa off of the no vote he cast on Monday.
You know, Republicans are going to vote against a crisis, not for this bill. I think you're going to find the vast majority of the people do not believe in this bill, do not believe it's the bill it should have been here. But given a choice between a crisis and a bad bill, many are choosing the bad bill. But again, that's for the voters to decide.
The rescue plan came too late for many small businesses already hurt by the credit crunch, and the reverberations are likely to be felt for some time to come in California. Peter John Schuller has that part of the story.
In today's world, credit is the grease that keeps the wheels of business running. Bob Edelstein, professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, says without that grease, the machine is in danger of breaking down.
In a globalized society where you trade and do business with lots of people, you need credit, at least temporary credit, to carry inventories so you can do production, sell things, hold things, and this is affecting everything.
In the last few months, the mortgage crisis has led to banks shutting off credit to businesses in nearly every sector, from hardware stores and machine shops to confectioners. Businesses in California related to construction and the automobile industry have been hardest hit. A new American Express study shows more than half of all businesses in the western states expect to have cash flow problems this year, about on par with the rest of the nation. Bay Area business consultant Brent Myers, CEO of the Corporation for Manufacturing Excellence, says without access to credit, his clients can't make the equipment upgrades to help them stay competitive.
The pendulum has swung so far to the side of conservatism on the lending side that even the businesses that logically ought to be getting and are wholly deserving of funding and financing just cannot find it in the current marketplace.
This is a showroom showing the samples that we've made to show colors or cuts of wood. Like over there is quarter sawn white oak with a kiwi.
The credit crunch has hit home hard for Christopher Hildreth and his wife Janet, co-owners of Tree Lovers Floors, a high-end hardwood flooring company operating in San Francisco since 1972. First, their phones stopped ringing in August when consumers started curtailing spending on home improvements. Janet Hildreth says many customers just decided to put off their projects till the economy settled down. And then the banks started pulling their lines of credit.
I've lost all but $100,000 of my lines of credit because I haven't been using them. That was one excuse. One was IndyMac, so of course we know what happened there. So where 6 months ago, I was in a really good position to handle this problem. I'm now not in that. I'm not in a very good position to handle any shortfalls that we might come up against.
Christopher Hildreth says the 1-2 punch has forced them to lay off about 20 of their 40 employees.
You know, if you got a payroll of $40,000 a week, and you're not getting paid by your contractors, and your customers are they're a little slow paying, or they're holding 10% retention, whatever the reason is. Yeah, you can have $100,000, $200,000 in receivables and have only $50,000 in the bank. That's not going to last you more than a week.
Even in Silicon Valley's high-tech sector, one of the brighter spots in the California economy, companies are feeling the pinch, both from customers putting off purchases and smaller manufacturers that supply the big high-tech firms, president of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, Carl Guardino.
What's fascinating is this financial crisis, the impact here in Silicon Valley is across sectors. It's across all clusters of high tech, life sciences, financial institutions. Every type of business is impacted when your customers or your own company can no longer finance deals or purchases.
Even banks that are still honoring their ongoing relationships with their clients are being cautious. Peggy Bradshaw is director of small business banking with Comerica Bank.
I don't know what my colleagues have done, but if someone already has a line of credit for stocking inventory or cash flow from before they collect on receivables, et cetera, that credit is still available to them. There's less new credit available, but the credit that they're already committed to is available.
Many experts say the Wall Street bailout may come too late for some small businesses. Credit requirements have become stricter, and that means businesses are putting off spending, leading to further contraction. And experts say the momentum of the credit squeeze is likely to lead to more business failures. For the California Report, I'm Peter John Schuler.
Only citizens have the right to vote in most U.S. elections. That's one reason Latino organizations have launched a nationwide effort to get new citizens registered to vote in next month's election. But many non-citizens are finding other ways to participate in the political process. As part of our ongoing series with the Latino Public Radio Network Radio Bilingue, reporter Zadie Stavely shows how non-citizens are registering voters, knocking on doors, and making phone calls.
It's the night of the first presidential debate, and Fresno State University's campus bar, The Bucket, is hosting a debate-watching party. Senior Sarait Martinez greets students at the door.
So if you guys want to join, we have a sign-in sheet. Get it.
The 21-year-old Martinez came to the U.S. from the Mexican state of Oaxaca 6 years ago during high school. Now she's active in a campaign to register other students to vote, even though she herself cannot cast a ballot, at least not yet.
I need to, until next April, I'll be having 5 years with my residence card. So after that, I can apply for my citizenship. So I cannot vote, unfortunately, in this election.
That's not stopping her from getting involved. In addition to registering other students, Martinez is coordinating an effort to organize community forums on the state ballot propositions and mobilize students to the polls. She's passionate about getting others to vote, in part because many of her friends are undocumented and won't have a voice on election day.
And I know a lot of students that cannot apply for financial aid. I mean, they have to pay the books by their pocket. I mean, they have to work. I mean, they're with the fear of, oh, what am I going to do after I graduate? I have no papers. I cannot apply to jobs. And that's one of my concerns, too, to educate students for the ones that can do something.
Martinez is one of a growing number of non-citizens who are getting involved in encouraging eligible Latinos to register and vote. The Bay Area-based Immigrant Legal Resource Center recently co-sponsored a training in Modesto for promotores del voto, or people who promote voting. Community organizers Socorro Cáceres and Noé Páramo act out a skit showing how to encourage people to register.
Si no lo haces ahorita, a lo mejor ya al rato se te pasa el tiempo. Ya mejor lo te registro ahorita.
¿Las tienes las formas contigo?
Sí, de una vez hay que hacerlo, ¿sí?
The crowd is enthusiastic. Most of those being trained today are citizens, many recently naturalized. But Paramo estimates about 30% of those his local organization has trained over the past 3 years are not citizens, including Elena Gutierrez, a permanent resident who's here today.
I tell my kids they have to go vote, and my husband too, because if I don't tell them, they won't vote. Now I'm going to tell my nieces and nephews and everyone else, because they're the ones who can vote.
The Immigrant Legal Resource Center is supporting a number of small community organizations to encourage immigrants, citizens and non-citizens alike, to promote voting. Attorney Eric Cohen leads many of the trainings up and down the Central Valley. He likes to tell the story of how at one training, a woman told him she was undocumented, but she voted 10 times every election.
And I said, well, you know, I'm a lawyer. That's against the law. First of all, you're not allowed to vote more than once. And second of all, you're not allowed to vote if you're not a citizen. And she said, well, let me tell you how I do it. Every election, I knock on 10 people's doors who I know, 10 friends who aren't going to vote. And I encourage them to vote. And I help them learn all the different propositions and candidates. And therefore, I actually, it's as if I voted 10 times.
Cohen says they're doing nothing illegal since they are not encouraging people who can't vote to cast ballots. But not everyone will agree. Some, like Jay Labadie of the town of Clovis, outside Fresno, says he doesn't see a distinction between undocumented residents voting themselves and encouraging others to vote.
What's the difference? They're not breaking a law. Well, somebody hasn't made it a law yet. It's wrong and it's not right.
Labadie speaks for those who feel that American elections are for American citizens, period.
Living in this country is a privilege. A lot of people that have come into the country have done it the right way. They've gained citizenship, and it belittles those people when somebody else who is here illegally tries to influence the elections.
Whether you like the idea of non-citizens participating in our election or not, their involvement is growing. Outside the St. Anthony Mary Claret Church in Fresno, organizer Leonel Flores is calling on churchgoers to register. He says he knows some people criticize non-citizens for getting involved in the electoral process, but he thinks it's important in order to build a stronger democracy. Flores started organizing people to become citizens and vote in 1994 when the anti-immigrant measure Proposition 187 was on the ballot. And after it passed, he helped start citizenship classes at this church. He's been especially interested in promoting the vote since the immigration marches that began in May 2006, where immigrants chanted, "Today we march, tomorrow we vote."
So this message was in all the radio stations, all the TV stations, and all the rallies. So this message came inside of us. It's why many, many students, many people, many youth who are undocumented, they feel they are part of this society. So it's why they are doing this, to promote the vote.
That's something that appears to be happening all over the country since the immigrant marches. Gaspar Rivera is project director at the UCLA Labor Center. He's helping research a nationwide project to find out how immigrants are organizing during this election year. He's found non-citizens, including undocumented immigrants, not only registering others to vote, but doing phone banking and canvassing for the Obama campaign in key swing states such as Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico.
I sense that with those undocumented that have political consciousness and that are very active, they're very passionate in telling the Latino citizens to tell them, hey, you can make a difference. Look at me. I'm undocumented. I'm mobilizing. But you both can count.
Involvement of non-citizens in this year's campaign could be controversial. But with polls showing the presidential election still too close to call, their participation could help make the difference in who becomes the next president of the United States. For the California Report, I'm Zadie Stavely in Fresno.
Zadie brought her camera with her as she reported this story. To see her photos and to hear the other stories in this series, go to our website, californiareport.org. By the way, her story and anything else you hear on our show is available for takeout. Sign up for our podcast at californiareport.org. Again, that's californiareport.org. ¶¶ Pinball may seem a bit primitive and slow compared with today's dizzying video games, but that metal ball bouncing off bumpers, setting off bells, and blinking lights still has passionate fans. This weekend, many of them are descending on the San Francisco Bay Area for one of the country's largest pinball expos. Jacob Fenston has more.
It's 9:59 Friday morning, and hundreds of pinball machines, new and old, are lit up and waiting for their adoring public. A minute later, the Pacific Pinball Expo in San Rafael opens its doors, and dozens of pinball players, collectors, and curious fans flow in.
I play all the machines I can, just to see how different they are, how they respond from the oldest machine to the newest.
For the same reason, I might go see an 80s band at a concert. Playing these machines brings back a lot of memories, like an old song.
I consider them really art to me. They're just beautiful.
It's overwhelming, sensory overwhelming.
The expo was born from the fevered brains of two pinball addicts.
I always just was fascinated by the fact that we as a society would build a machine that was purely for amusement. I just thought it was kind of a neat achievement for us as a society.
Michael Schiess bought his first pinball machine when he was 14. 39 years later, that would be 2007, he and his buddy Jim Dietrich decided their fellow Americans didn't have a proper appreciation for the game.
It's something that is more American than apple pie.
Sure, there were other pinball shows. A big one in Chicago has been going since 1984, but none, says Schiess, that highlights the game's rich history. So at the show in San Rafael, there are hundreds of vintage machines, and most of them you can actually play. That's because Schiess and his friends spent the past 2 months holed up in an Alameda warehouse repairing dozens of dusty old games.
Now, here's where the fun begins. Time to put her back together and see if it'll go.
Chris Nash, who calls himself the Pinball Doctor of Portland, drove down from Oregon to help fix machines.
He's the man. He's been fixing all these machines. You know, as long as I keep the door locked and feed him and give him parts and...
I got a place to stay and food in my mouth, then I'm happy.
Pinball's ancestor, Bagatelle, was invented in France and made its way across the Atlantic about the same time as the Statue of Liberty. In the hands of business-minded Americans, it moved from gentlemen's parlors to teenagers' arcades.
I'll show you our front room here.
She says he loves pinball because the machines reflect the society that created them.
You're looking at about 250 machines inside this big room. And just about every machine's got a story behind it. When you look at all of these, that's a lot of stories.
In cartoony reproductions, he says, pinball machines reflected our hopes, our dreams, and our prejudices. During World War II, America's enemies suddenly appeared on the playfields in games like Bomb the Axis Rats and Slap the Japs. In happier times, pinball execs used pop culture and music to lure in adolescent boys with spare change. Like this game, a 1967 machine called Beat Time.
You see the people on it, it's cartoon caricatures of the Beatles, but they couldn't put that on there because they get sued by the Beatles, so they changed the name to The Boodles. They did that all the time.
Here goes all the cookies in the farm, and if it blows up...
Nash is trying to fix a game called Rotation. If it blows up, he says, they'll blame me. But he plugs it in and...
Oh my God, it's up.
It works, mostly.
Oh, this one's, oh, this, the button is stuck.
It's the weirdest pinball machine I've ever seen. It's short and squat, like a round coffee table. Four players can sit around it, and it rotates to face you when it's your turn.
Now it should rotate. Here it goes. Here it goes. Look at that.
She says there's a resurgence of interest in pinball. About 2,000 people came to the show last year, and he expects about twice as many this year. The Pacific Pinball Expo runs through Sunday at the San Rafael Civic Center in Marin. For the California Report, I'm Jacob Funston.
You can see pictures of all those machines and more at our website, CaliforniaReport.org. Author Fran Lebowitz once said sarcastically, "Your life story would not make a good book. Don't even try." But the new San Francisco-based business, FieldReport.com, has other ideas. The company is giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars for people's true life stories. Lisa Morehouse reports.
FieldReport.com is a website that merges elements of reality TV with the personal essay. During month-long rounds of submissions, writers can upload short nonfiction to one of 20 categories of life experience, like love and hate or crisis mode. Each piece of writing is rated by Field Report members, and after every round, one person in each category wins $1,000. In Field Report's beta contest this summer, Dave Chambers won in the food and drink category for his piece, Champagne Love.
I drove from Paris to Champagne on a Sunday and arrived to find nothing open. Nothing open. Now, on a Sunday in Napa, Highway 29 is in gridlock. On the proceeds from Sunday alone, Napa winemakers can make their boat payments. Well, on a Sunday in Champagne region, wine growers are with their families. I guess they don't need boats as much as well-adjusted families. So for my lunch
Dave
that day,
Chambers is a wine merchant. He leads tasting classes like this, runs an online wine club and a wine shop in Solvang. He also, as he says, sinks money into an olive orchard in Boonville. Now, thanks to Field Report, he's a paid writer.
Okay, and here comes the Viognier.
In January, Field Report's members will award one contributor $250,000.
Let's say that again. They're giving away $250,000.
That may be the biggest chunk of change ever given to a single piece of writing in a contest.
The business model is really turning everything on its head. It's everybody gets posted, and then the writers decide who gets the money. I think it's really going to be a sight to watch.
That's certainly what Field Report founder Will Petty hopes. The prizes draw the writers in, but Petty wants to create an encyclopedia of human experiences. And after seeing sites where writing was judged simply by the number of hits and hearing of people paying PR agencies to boost their ratings, Petty was craving some objectivity.
I wanted to create a site where the ranking would be truly objective and where really good quality content would be recognized independent of these exterior factors.
To that end, Field Report developed software which feeds essays to reviewers anonymously. When a piece starts moving to the top of its category, the system ensures it gets reviewed by more and more readers to increase the accuracy of its ranking. Sarah Nelson is editor-in-chief of Publishers Weekly. In the last couple of years, she's seen books which first appeared on internet sites picked up by publishers.
Whereas one time internet publishers were completely apart from traditional publishers, now they're a little bit of breeding ground for them.
Nelson says the popularity of online publishing shows dissatisfaction with traditional publishing.
All that said, I think that what traditional publishing does do is provide, it's kind of become a bad word a little bit, but gatekeepers, impartial judges of material.
The gatekeepers on Field Report are its own members, who've ranked about 1,500 submissions. Half of the winners and contributors make some of their living writing. The other half include an adoption specialist, an art teacher, a plumber. The big winner in the site's beta version is a mail carrier from Oregon. Graduate student Jackie Shine won in the friends and family category with a story about an evening she and her mom spent listening to a tape of her college radio show.
You're listening to 91.9 WOZQ. I'm Jackie, and this is After School Special. This week's theme is Songs My Mom Likes.
I remember the 35 sweet goodbyes.
For a while, we keep talking, but the conversation starts to fade in and out as we drop words to pick up a lyric instead. By the third Steely Dan song, we've left the old hurts and secrets for another day, smoothing them over by singing together. Tonight I'm surprised by the stories I told on the air that morning, all tender and sometimes funny.
Shine had already written this piece, which she calls a memoir of feeling. She was excited to share it with others and was attracted to the cash prize. She bought a bike and paid off a credit card with her winnings. And while she thinks we'll see increased democratization of writing on the web, she's not sure the Field Report community replaces professional editing.
Whether or not it's going to be the community that they dream of, I don't know. Getting constructive and rigorous feedback is going to be really difficult.
Investors ponied up the initial funds for the company and its prizes, but Petty expects to fund Field Report through advertising, self-publishing, and creating an independent trust where members can archive stories on the internet in perpetuity, regardless of Field Report's staying power. That permanence appeals to wine merchant Dave Chambers.
It's like graffiti. You know, I mean, it's like, I was here. It's going to be out there forever. It's like a hand painting on the caves of the cavemen, you know?
Field Report's next deadline is October 15th. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. The director is Nina Thorson. Seal Mahler is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Dan Bringer. Our interns are Darlene Bruchard, Heather Gilligan, and Catherine Castleman. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our producer is Susie Racho. Pat Flynn was a contributing editor. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker, and our news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Political coverage in collaboration with Radio Bilingüe is made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org.